Broadcasting from Manhattan Beach and the World Wide Web, you're listening to CHSR, HealthyLife.net.
As a service to our listeners, this program is for general information and entertainment purposes only. CHSRHealthyLife.net does not recommend, endorse, or object to the views, products, or topics expressed or discussed by show hosts or their guests. We suggest you always consult with your own personal, medical, financial, or legal advisor.
Good morning and welcome to Cosmic Influence. My name is Walter Cruttenden and it is a pleasure to be with you again this morning. As most of our regular listeners know, this show explores the possibility that civilization rises and falls in a great cycle. Plato called this the Great Year. And ancient cultures all over the world spoke of it. In fact, Giorgio de Santayana, the former professor of the history of science at MIT, wrote a book called Hamlet's Mill, along with his co-author Hertha von Deschen. And in that, they documented over 30 ancient cultures and over 200 myths and folk stories that talked about this rise and fall of civilization. And so it is really a very common, prevalent notion, really the number one paradigm of history prior to the Christian period, the idea that things were just started 6,000 years ago with Adam and Eve, sort of took over the Great Year idea sometime around the medieval period. That lasted for a while, and then that itself was replaced by the linear idea, the ideas of Spencer and Darwin that came along about 150 years ago, the idea of evolution. And I certainly believe in evolution on a very long-term basis, but I also think that it is punctuated by periods of change and cycles within that. And the ancients tell us that really everything is cyclical, and that this great cycle, the one that Plato called the Great Year, the one that the Indians called the Yuga cycle, the one that the Maya call the different suns, or the Hopi call the different worlds, is also driven by a celestial motion. And so just as we have the Earth spin on its axis and it gives us the cycle of night and day, and we have the Earth going around the sun, gives us the cycle of the seasons, so too did the ancients say that there's an even larger motion. The whole solar system slowly moving around another star, producing the observable called the precession of the equinox. Now, most scientists today would tell us that the precession of the equinox is just a mere wobbling of the Earth, and it really has no effect on consciousness or history whatsoever. And yet, one has to wonder then why so many ancient cultures tied this movement of the stars, this precession of the equinox, where the equinox slowly goes through one constellation after another, each one taking about 2,000 years, why they all said that civilization rises and falls in sync with this. And if the Earth just sits there and wobbles, well, then there's probably not a lot of truth to the old myths. But if, in fact, the Earth and the sun does go around another star, then indeed we have a basis for basically the Earth going on a trillion-mile journey over this roughly 24,000 period of years, in which we'd go closer to this other star for about half that period of time and then away from this other star for about the same period of time. And thus, we'd have the basis or the fundamentals for a great cycle that the ancients talked about. By the way, much of this research that we're presenting here is in my book, Lost Star of Myth and Time, or you can find it online at the Binary Research Institute. And that's where I work every day and my partners work and where we're really exploring the mythology, the archaeology, and the astronomy behind this great cycle. In fact, last week I had the pleasure of visiting some scientists up at Stanford, and we were looking into the GPB program. That's the Gravity Probe B program, cooked up by Stanford and NASA to figure out whether or not general relativity really works. And so what they've done is they've put a satellite up above the Earth about 400 miles in a polar orbit, and it has the finest gyros ever built. And one of them is kept in a free fall. And so these gyros are attached to a telescope that itself is pointed at a guide star. And so they hope to find the geodetic effect, which is about, six arc seconds per year of bent space-time, and the frame-dragging effect, which is sort of related to torsion, where the whole mass of the Earth would be sort of twisting a spot in space. And that's a very small effect, less than an arc second. In any event, these scientists hope to find that. And for our purposes, we think this is a very exciting experiment, because not only should they be able to find those effects, but as they're in the process of trying to find these very small effects, essentially changes in the Earth orientation, they should be able to pick up larger effects, such as the satellite's orbit around the Earth, of course, and the Earth's orbit around the Sun. And if indeed we are in a binary system, our whole solar system's motion around another star. And so that is something that we are talking to them about, and we had some real heavy guys in the room, and they're actually quite interested. They themselves are talking about ideas like Nemesis and a black hole, which got me thinking that they must be seeing something, or they wouldn't be bringing these ideas up. In any event, we'll be talking more about that in future shows, and today we have a very special guest, Gene Houston, that we'll be bringing on shortly. But now we need to take a short break, and once again, you are listening to Cosmic Influence.
Expanding your mind. HealthyLife.net.
Welcome back to Cosmic Influence. My name is Walter Cruttenden, and we have a very special guest with us today. She is an author that I have really just become acquainted with, although I've heard her name for many, many years, and that is Jean Houston. Jean Houston is an author of 19 books, including the best-selling The Possible Human, The Search for the Beloved, A Mythic Life, and A Passion for the Possible. And I'm reading Jump Time right now, and it's just fascinating. Not only does Jean's heart and rich philosophy come through her words, but she has a simple, clean, clear, engaging writing style that really makes it a pleasure to read. She's an internationally renowned scholar, philosopher, teacher, co-director of the Foundation for Mind Research in New York. She has served in the field of human development in many countries and is a consultant to UNICEF and other national and international agencies. And she's probably considered really the mother of the human potential movement. And so I'd like to welcome now Jean Houston.
Thank you. Just a few corrections. There's 25 books, and I'm working now with the United Nations Development Program. I'm the senior consultant to the United Nations in human development.
I think you've written more books than I've read, Jean.
I doubt that very much.
You know, I'm just fascinated with your work, and the first thing that really comes to mind is, how did little Jeannie Houston get this way? I was reading, you know, that you were quite a singer in your early years, and I guess very excellent, and had grown up around the stage. But what sort of really molded you in your early life to look at life so broadly the way you do now?
Well, I think it's because of just what you said, looking at life broadly. I came from a hybrid world. My mother was, her name was Maria Annunziata Serafina Graziella Fiorina Perpetua Todaro. She was born in Syracuse, Sicily, and she married Jack Houston from Texas. So that already was a kind of strange hybrid vigorous impetus. And then my father was a well-known comedy writer, among other things. He's one of the guys who wrote Who's On First, that famous joke.
Oh, yeah.
And we were always on the road from the time practically I was born till about the time I was about 11-ish. And so I went to 20 schools before I was 12 years old. And if you were going in those days to school in Bemidji, Minnesota one day, in Biloxi, Mississippi the next, you were in totally different realities. So I had to learn to adapt very, very quickly.
Well,
growing up in show business was always very exciting because one got to see such a rich variety of not just of roles and peoples, but, you know, you could really incarnate that incredible entertainment reality. I remember once my father taking me to the MGM lot, and at that point they made 365 pictures a day, so I would sit down and watch while Marie Antoinette went by with the French court, and then I'd watch, people from a film about the Crusades meet with people making a film about Hawaii, and so one was able to have within it, like, the world mind taking a walk with itself.
Well, that would certainly give you a wide perspective, and I know, other people have had exposure to many cultures, too, but few seem to have the depth of philosophy that I've seen in your work. And did I read also that there was a mystical experience or two in your childhood?
Oh, yeah, I had a tremendous experience when my father used to give me embarrassing questions to ask the poor little nun in the morning, like Sister Teresa, when Jesus rose, was that because God filled him full of helium? And Sister Teresa, did Jesus ever have to go to the bathroom? Well, with a series of questions like that, she gave me 300 million years in purgatory. And so I went home crying, and my father took me to a movie playing at the time called The Song of Bernadette. But we had to leave fairly early because he got hysterical because he recognized the lady who was actually playing the Virgin Mary, who was anything but. And so when I went home, I prayed in the closet for the Virgin Mary to show up in the closet, and I kept praying and giving up things. I gave up candy. I gave up calories. You know, I just kept broccoli, which I hated. And no Virgin Mary showed up, but I went and sat by the window seat and looked out, you know, at the fig tree and the ground and the plane in the sky, and suddenly all of reality was there. And I knew absolutely that I and the fig tree in the yard and the plane in the sky and my little shoes and my Dick and Jane reader and the new wheat in Kansas and old ladies dying at the hospital and fish in Sheepshead Bay and literally all of reality was apparent, and it was all deeply interwoven. I was in a universe of fellowship and of a kind of unified cosmos, and I knew that it was all good. And then a few seconds later, although it felt like a million years later, my father entered laughing, which was characteristic. And immediately the whole universe began to laugh. Everything laughed. It was an incredible joyousness that was this great sustenance of the universe. And years later, when I could read Dante's Paradiso, the original, great line, del riso dell'universo, the joy that spins the universe. And I knew that's what I had seen. And I think so deep was that experience of the deep interrelationship of everything, Dave, with everything else, and that the fact that ultimately it was all very, very good, and that we were all an intricate part of it. We were part of the great hologram of being.
It sounds a lot like the many mystic experiences from the East, some of the yogis that I've read about, samadhi, nirvana-type experiences. Did you relate it to anything like that, or how old were you at the time?
I was
6 years old.
Related to those, no. But years later, when I studied those things, of course, I saw some similarities, except it was the abundance of totality, that we are citizens in a universe larger than our aspiration and far, far more complex than all our dreams. And so I think that gave me the impetus to, in part, to study the human potential and to really go out and do something about it, because we can no longer afford to live as half-light versions of ourselves. You know, if the world is going to survive, we really need to tap into the immense treasures that lie within us and around us. And, you know, these are the times where the people, I've realized, other times in history thought they were it. They're wrong. This is it. This is the single most important time in human history. And what we do now will profoundly make a difference as to whether we grow or die.
I completely agree with you. You know, a lot of authors have talked about or written about this sort of quickening that seems to be happening on planet Earth right now, this awakening or expansion of consciousness. Mm-hmm. And yet, you know, few have explored as many diverse cultures as you have. So I'm kind of interested in your perspective on this whole thing as to how you would describe what is happening on Earth or consciousness, and maybe even after that, how America's view of this might differ from some other cultures.
Yes. Well, what I'm finding around the world, because I've been in 100 countries, lectured in 100 countries, and I've worked intensively in 40 cultures, is that all over the world there is this impetus, this rising sense of a new reality, even within some of the most impoverished countries, which I've been working in. I mean, some people are so overwhelmed by their poverty and disease that there's barely a glimmering of light to anything else. But you find that once people get moderately comfortable, that sensibility is there again, that they know that we are in what we would call a singularity in history. Nothing like this has ever happened before, and it's brought about by factors that are absolutely unique in human experience. I mean, not just the obvious interconnected world or interneted world, but the planetary noosphere, the field of mind, the world mind taking a walk with itself. But perhaps even more importantly, the fact that something is rising in the human psyche that was perhaps activated by these external events. But whether it was external or internal, they're working together, this whole sense that we are part of the greatest movement and change, and what we do will make the difference. So I really find it all over. I think even fundamentalisms are part of this in a kind of shadow way, that we are part of something huge that is trying to happen in human history. Now, we can lose it. I mean, Joanna Macy, one of the great women of our time, says, you know, we can lose it. We certainly are losing the diversity of the species. We are losing the ecology. Until recently in America, we were even losing the sense of what it was that was so great about our country. But now this is changing. I mean, we have turned the page on human history. I think in America today, where you and I are talking just a few days after the elections, which I think were very significant, but also because we are talking at a time in which history itself is rising up to say, enough of these old ways, enough of the enmity of nations, enough of this. This is the time in which what we do can really change the whole story. We are at the beginning of a whole new story that has to do with a planetary civilization, with high individuation of culture, with women rising to full partnership with men in the whole domain of human affairs, with a revolution in the understanding of learning and education. I mean, I, for one, have never seen a stupid child. I've seen incredibly stupid and demeaning systems of education. But now we know that if we put art back as critical to the curriculum, if a child is dancing and singing and emoting and crafting information, they simply do not fail. And I've created many, many, many of these kinds of schools all over the world where children rush to school because it's so exciting and interesting. You know, we're also in a time in which the Zeit is getting geisty, in which the spirit is rising in new ways. We have access to the spiritual practices of thousands of years of many, many different kinds of people, whether it's Sufi dancing and philosophy of love, or whether it is the Kabbalistic understanding of the depths of cosmic experience within the human being, or whether it is Christian-centering prayer, or the great shamanic glories of the understanding of our soul's relationship to nature. This kind of great marshaling of the genius of the spiritual traditions is now available to us in ways that never were there before. We are experiencing the harvest of the world's genius as it has been engendered in so many different cultures and peoples.
Well, you really bring it home. And, you know, ancient cultures have talked about this thing happening, this cycle with these rising and falling ages.
Yes.
And that's one thing, of course, we study at the Binary Research Institute. And so some people would tell us that this awakening, or part of it, at least, may be due to this expected point that we're at in the Yuga cycle, or the great year, as Plato called it.
Yes.
And I was wondering if you've seen any evidence of that in other cultures. In other words, have any other cultures you studied indicated that this awakening was prophesized or expected in any way?
Well, I think, you know, you have to make the distinction between the fact that prophecy always prophesizes. In any given time, prophecy prophesizes the end of things and the beginning of new things. The whole idea of a new age is something that goes back to the book of Daniel, and you find it also on the dollar bill, Novum Ordem Seclorum. You find it in Joachim de Fiore, in writing in the 14th century. You find it in Haeckel, in Lessing, in Marx. You find it now. There's always been the sense of the imminence of the unexpected and the great turning, the great transition. This seems to be part of our psychic equipment, as it were. Now, it's true, with so many people from all over the world, you know, being in a time of such uniqueness, you know, people are picking up on some of these ancient prophetic traditions, like the 2012 tradition that you find among the Mayans and other people, Hispanic peoples. Traditions that are implicit in various scriptures the world over. I, for one, just don't know. I mean, obviously, I can't address that. But I do think that from my perspective, what I am seeing around the world is the rise of shadows that are so great they are virtually apocalyptic. You know, when you have been, as I have been, in very poor countries with children dying of AIDS in your arms, or the cholera epidemics, or seeing the mutilation of women, or seeing poverty so intense that people live on far less than a quarter a day, not to speak of a dollar a day, you also see the rising shadows that seem to be running in concert with the rising light. So I think that it is, and by no means determined that we will make it, but it is certainly determined that we have an opportunity that is ours, that has never been there before in human history. And as Einstein said, the consciousness that created the problems cannot be the same consciousness that solves it, which is one of the reasons why I run around the world like I do, working and retraining leaders in their own development in the light of social complexity, which I call social artistry, because, you know, I find that most leaders have been trained to be white males of the year 1926. They have not been trained for the incredible complexity of today, and they will not do well by the world if they continue in these narrow and insular attitudes, which we are seeing exploding around us in the shadow plays of fundamentalism.
Well, hopefully there's some big changes coming, and we can start to talk about some of those changes. But right now, Gene, we have to take a short break.
All right.
You are listening to Cosmic Influence with our special guest today, Gene Houston, and we will be right back.
If you are interested in the topics discussed on today's show, you'll want to see Walter Crittenden's award-winning film, The Great Year, narrated by James Earl Jones. Why do civilizations fall and rise again? What did the ancients say about the cycle of the ages? The Great Year explores the possibility that the rise and fall of human culture might be related to our sun's motion around a companion star. Find out more about the celestial mechanics that bring higher ages of enlightenment and learn where we are today in this grand cycle of time. It's a message of hope and inspiration and answers many questions about the greatest enigmas of human history. Order the DVD today at thegreatyear.com. That's www.thegreatyear.com. www.thegreatyear.com. The Great Year.com.
Lost Star of Myth and Time by Walter Cruttenden is the hot new bestseller, stirring controversy with a new view of ancient history. Graham Hancock calls the evidence in this epic book the key to the mystery of the ages. Where is present-day civilization headed? What did the ancients know about the cosmos? Do stellar influences affect consciousness and the rise and fall of civilization? Lost Star of Myth and Time answers these questions and more. Lost Star of Myth and Time at a bookstore near you.
For all your live or pre-recorded webcasting needs, come to earthchannel.com. Get your web-based message out to a select group or the whole world. It's easy. A pioneer in webcasting, earthchannel.com provides the best products and services to big corporations and government users. And now, this same technology is available to you. They have the best earthcast encoders, servers, and products to meet your technical needs. But wait, don't want to mess with technical stress? No problem. They'll do it for you. earthchannel.com is your answer. You can use webcasting for lots of things, like advertising, marketing, customer support, training, and don't forget, web radio and TV. In fact, you're listening to a live Earthcast right now, so come to earthchannel.com. Actualize your audio or video webcasting needs today. You can't beat the friendly service or the price. Call earthchannel.com at 800-849-8978. That's 800-849-8978.
HealthyLife.net, the positive radio network.
Welcome back to Cosmic Influence. My name is Walter Cruttenden, and we are speaking with our guest today, Jean Houston. If at any time you would like more information on Jean or her books, please go to jeanhouston.org. She has a number of seminars in addition to her other work. One is called The Mystery School, and it's a fascinating body of work, so I would encourage all of you that are interested in learning more about her work to go to the website and click on Mystery School. Jean, right before the break, we were starting to talk about some of the changes, and you know, just looking back at the last 100 years, we've seen amazing changes. Who would have thought that, you know, we could perform heart lung transplants or fly to the moon, or that we'd all be carrying around little devices where we could instantly talk to somebody on the other side of the world? And yet today those things are commonplace. And I'm not saying that the technology per se is so great, but the technology is a proxy for our creativity, our inventiveness, and hopefully we can bring that creativity, inventiveness into other areas of life, which I sense is what your work is about and what is so desperately needed here on planet Earth. And can you touch on some of the changes that you see that are needed, and things that you see that are coming that might be helpful?
Yes, by the way, one of the greatest inventions of all is air conditioning. Because, no, truly, whole big southern regions where simply you just couldn't work. You couldn't do, you really had to put away half the day, if not more. Air conditioning has really helped enormously. Well, you're quite right, and it's also true that the last 40 or 50 years, more history has happened than in the previous 2,000 all told. So we're living in these accelerated times, and certainly there's an accelerated creativity. Now, the problem is that you need to balance this external creativity, that deals with devices and technology, with the high technology of the inner life. Because otherwise, we just become materialistic and utterly outward-directed people. You know, creativity doesn't have to be for something outside of yourself. It is nothing that probably the best creation is the recreation of oneself. So I've made a study over many years of 55 of some of the most sustained creative people in North America. Among my research subjects, these are people who worked with me personally over many years, were Margaret Mead, the great anthropologist who lived with us off and on the last 6 years of her life, Joseph Campbell for 20 years, Linus Pauling, Jonas Salk, Buckminster Fuller, and other people whose names you would not know but who had sustained this high creativity. And what I found was in every case, is that each one of these people were archaeologists of their own minds. They were spelunkers in the caves of their creativity. They had access to their inner images. They could see, you know, see things. They'd close their eyes and they would see pictures for the most part. They could hear with their inner ears. They could touch. They could smell, taste. They had all the inner images. And as you develop inner imagery, which is a very easy thing to do, as you develop, and I teach that in some of my courses, as you develop that, you find that you have the hooks and eyes, you have the material inside of you that will catch the creative ideas that you're working with or the creative processes that are going on all the time. And so you also find that with all these people, they were all rather merry because they were rather jolly folk, you know, because they had this whole sense of being co-creating with the cosmos and inventing, and it gives a huge surge of yes, a huge impetus of being right on track with one's highest destiny, with one's deepest purpose.
That
so
is...
many people feel all dressed up with no place to go because they're not using enough of themselves. They're not tapping into these infinite treasures that lie within. And these treasures are not simply that which is gathered from one's own personal experience. It's partly that, but it's also that there are windows and portals in the mind that open us to the universe itself, to the great creative treasures that are there. I have studied people like Hildegard of Bingen, who lived in about the 12th century and had no reason to create as much advanced art, music, botany, medicine, statecraft, theology that was hundreds of years ahead of her, but she would tap into these creative domains and come out with these things. In my studies now of literally thousands of people on the creative matrix, we find that all of us have access to worlds within worlds, creative solutions, problem solvings, inventions, ways of seeing new perspectives on our own and the reality at large that are way beyond anything that we could have thought of. I think of Enid Blyton, you know, who wrote 400 very good children's stories, and they asked her, she was an English lady, how can you create so much and it's such quality? And she said, well, when I create, I put my typewriter on my knee with the paper in it, and I just watch, and I have very good imagery and good internal senses. So I watch as the little characters play out, and I just type what they do and say. And once in a while, one of them makes a joke, a jolly good one, and I laugh and laugh and laugh and laugh and laugh. And I think, you know, I couldn't have thought of that in 100 years, but then I wonder who thought of it. And it's this great who-ness that lies within us that gives us access to so much invention, creation, and possibility. You see, when people tap into this, they get thrilled. I mean, they really enter into vast enthusiasms. I mean, think of the root Greek word of enthusiasm, entheos eiasmos. They are filled by the God of creation. And they tend to be very happy folks because of that.
Well, happiness is certainly a key sign of an evolving soul. And hopefully, if our whole planet is evolving now, we're going to see more happiness or more people tapping into that. But right now we have to take another quick break, and we'll be back. You are listening to Cosmic Influence with our special guest, Gene Houston.
Lost Star of Myth and Time by Walter Cruttenden is the hot new bestseller, stirring controversy with a new view of ancient history. Graham Hancock calls the evidence in this epic book the key to the mystery of the ages. Where is present-day civilization headed? What did the ancients know about the cosmos? Do stellar influences affect consciousness and the rise and fall of civilization? Lost Star of Myth and Time answers these questions and more. Lost Star of Myth and Time at a bookstore near you.
What does HealthyLife.net and Amazon.com have in common? Well, they're both available on the internet. They both give great value. But most important, most of our positive program hosts and guests are accomplished authors, and their books are available from, you got it, Amazon.com. Now it even gets better than that, because when you're listening on air to a HealthyLife.net host or guest, you can go directly to Amazon.com and you can order your book while you're still listening to your favorite HealthyLife.net program. So when you hear an author you like, go to the homepage of HealthyLife.net and click on Amazon.com.
If you are interested in the topics discussed on today's show, you'll want to see Walter Cruttenden's award-winning film, The Great Year, narrated by James Earl Jones. Why do civilizations fall and rise again? What did the ancients say about the cycle of the ages? The Great Year explores the possibility that the rise and fall of human culture might be related to our sun's motion around a companion star. Find out more about the celestial mechanics that bring higher ages of enlightenment and learn where we are today in this grand cycle of time. It's a message of hope and inspiration and answers many questions about the greatest enigmas of human history. Order the DVD today at thegreatyear.com. That's www.thegreatyear.com. www.thegreatyear.com.
ByRegion.net is the largest healing arts directory on the web. Our visitors are looking for holistic practitioners, schools, events, healing services, and products. Are you in healing arts? Become a member of ByRegion.net and get the best advertising values. You can increase your client base and your traffic. If you have a website, we can bring you more traffic. Want a website? Get a beautiful web display for only $4 a month. Become a member now. Mention HealthyLife.net and get 6 months free. Visit www.byregion.net or call 828-232-0016.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
Welcome back to Cosmic Influence. I'm Walter Cruttenden, and we are speaking with special guest Jean Houston. If any of you would like more information on Jean's programs, which are numerous and fascinating, please go to her website. That's jeanhouston.org, jeanhouston.org. Or you could call a number, 541-488-1200. That's 541-488-1200 for news about upcoming seminars and the Mystery School.
And please come call only in business hours from 9 to 5, Monday through Friday.
Good. Okay. Jean, you know, you talked a little bit about sort of this this springtime of spirit, which you've seen and been privileged to see, really, in so many interesting individuals. I was also reading something in your book that said, essential to this matured consciousness is moral and ethical growth toward an empathy between individuals and nations that honors the golden rule of human interchange. And I couldn't agree more. And yet, you know, in society today, especially in some of the teen culture, and I hope I don't sound like my dad too much, you know, it seems like mores have fallen to some degree, even since the time we were playing around in the 60s. And do you have any thoughts about this, reflections on this?
Well, part of it is that the media focuses on the pathology. You know, at the same time, I can give you hundreds of examples of teenagers who are out there in social service really doing extraordinarily good things. But unfortunately, the media, especially the corporate media, not your kind of media, is focusing on people who are really doing some really dreadful things. But I think it is also true that being in an age of the great in-betweenness, it's as if we're at the end of one era and we're not quite at the beginning of the new one. We're the people of the parenthesis in which the future is seated and coded. And you always find, Walter, that in the times of the parenthesis, the moral structures tend to break down. Everything breaks down. Everything is up for grabs. But generally, it recapitulates and conforms again. It comes again at a higher level. But I find around the world so many young people are desperate for meaning, are seeking in all kinds of ways. I think that we actually are coming to an end of the, you know, the tragic and destructive use, you know, drugs and et cetera. But I think we're coming gradually to an end of that as people are trying to find new ways of making a difference, new ways of being.
Yes.
We do need models. There's no question of it. We do need models. We need, and especially in the media, good news networks, good news stories, stories of people who are out there and putting their passion for the possible on the line. I think we need more and more training. This is what I'm doing around the world. I'm actually training young leaders in their own development so that they can bring the muchness of who and what they are to major decision making. And there are many people like me out there doing this. So I don't think the same thing that everybody's always said, ain't it awful, because I have seen so many, many, many thousand examples of just the opposite. But that's not anything that gets the media coverage, you see.
Right. Well, I hear you loud and clear, and I do sense that there's great progress being made towards awakening, but as you point out, it's also a bit of a tumultuous time. I study Indian cultures quite a bit, Vedas, and they broke these ages into the Kali, Dwapara, Treta, and Satya Yugas,
yes,
equivalent to the Iron,
yes,
Bronze, Silver, and Golden Age. And, mm-hmm, and according to the scholars that I think are sort of the best out there, we're sort of in this transition from the Kali, the gross material age, where mankind only believes he's a physical being walking around in a physical world, to the Dwapara, where we start to realize, oh, it's all very ethereal. And indeed, our quantum physicists are telling us that, hey, it's energy. Matter per se is just elusive.
Yes, I mean that we are moving into a time of macro shift from old ways of being to new ways of being. And as you say, the energetic continuum is from the end of the Industrial Revolution, in which everything was so external and materialized, to an internal revolution, which is absolutely the needed correlate to begin to correct the excesses of the previous time. And I personally see this happening all over the world. Now, it's not happening for the media. It's not happening out front. But then I remember what E.F. Schumacher, who wrote Small is Beautiful, once said to me. He said, Gene, to get anything done in this world, you have to be beneath the line of contempt so that, you know, you are not, the focus is not upon you when you are literally in the, you are gestating in the womb of new becoming. So as I say, I'm rather glad in some sense that the media is not looking at that, because there are so many grassroots projects spreading all over the world that have to do with people taking deep commitment to the transformation of themselves and their societies. And this is happening with a kind of subtle stealth that is going on beneath the surface crust of consciousness of the world and beneath the line of contempt. But it's a powerful, powerful movement. And it is really the second superpower. We talk about America as the first superpower. But there is growing this grassroots movements of people all over the world where people are taking on the response abilities of making a better world. A lot of it is frankly led by women. People don't talk about it, especially women of a certain age. I find people, middle-aged women around the world, are leading all these different projects and these different agendas in health, in welfare, in relationships, in compassionate listening, in gender equality, in partnerships, in sustaining the ecology. Nobody's writing about this. I mean, you're probably going to hear it for the first time. But I'm out there, and I'm watching it happen. And it's almost the grandmas who are really the ones who are engaging this incredible change.
I couldn't agree more. I happen to know a couple of real movers and shakers of the female species in my own life, and
yes,
and it's been so positive. And I know that you've had a little bit of a relationship with Mrs. Clinton, and perhaps when we come back from this break we have to take right now,
sure,
you can tell us a little bit about that.
Sure.
You are listening to Cosmic Influence. I'm Walter Cruttenden with our guest Gene Houston, and we will be right back.
If you are interested in the topics discussed on today's show, you'll want to see Walter Cruttenden's award-winning film, The Great Year, narrated by James Earl Jones. Why do civilizations fall and rise again? What did the ancients say about the cycle of the ages? The Great Year explores the possibility that the rise and fall of human culture might be related to our sun's motion around a companion star. Find out more about the celestial mechanics that bring higher ages of enlightenment and learn where we are today in this grand cycle of time. It's a message of hope and inspiration. and answers many questions about the greatest enigmas of human history. Order the DVD today at thegreatyear.com. That's www.thegreatyear.com. www.thegreatyear.com.
Lost Star of Myth and Time by Walter Cruttenden is the hot new bestseller, stirring controversy with a new view of ancient history. Graham Hancock calls the evidence in this epic book the key to the mystery of the ages. Where is present-day civilization headed? What did the ancients know about the cosmos? Do stellar influences affect consciousness and the rise and fall of civilization? Lost Star of Myth and Time answers these questions and more. Lost Star of Myth and Time at a bookstore near you.
In college, I took a lot of history and liberal arts classes, and frankly, I don't remember much of any of it. But as an adult, I find myself engrossed in fascinating programs on the A&E and History Channel. They've pretty much helped me to be pretty impressive at social functions, and I just found out today that I can purchase DVDs of my favorite A&E and History Channel programs right through HealthyLife.net. You should visit HealthyLife.net and order your favorite A&E and History Channel program DVDs as well, and then discover how many people you can impress during your next social occasion.
For all your live or pre-recorded webcasting needs, come to earthchannel.com. Get your web-based message out to a select group or the whole world. It's easy. A pioneer in webcasting, earthchannel.com provides the best products and services to big corporations and government users. And now, this same technology is available to you. They have the best Earthcast encoders, servers, and products to meet your technical needs. But wait, don't want to mess with technical stress? No problem. They'll do it for you. earthchannel.com. Is your answer. You can use webcasting for lots of things, like advertising, marketing, customer support, training, and don't forget, web radio and TV. In fact, you're listening to a live Earthcast right now, so come to earthchannel.com. Actualize your audio or video webcasting needs today. You can't beat the friendly service or the price. Call earthchannel.com at 800-849-8978. That's 800-849-8978.
You're listening to HealthyLife.net, the radio network that brings positive talk with positive change to make your world a little better.
Welcome back to Cosmic Influence. I'm Walter Cruttenden, and we're talking with our guest today, Gene Houston, the author of 25 books and really the leader of the human potential movement. And Gene, right before the break, you were talking about how influential certain women have been in really helping this awakening along.
Yeah, and it's more than certain. It's actually millions of women around the world, I'm finding.
Well, the more the better, because we sure need it on this planet at this time. And I had been reading something where you had helped Hillary Clinton with her book, It Takes a Village, and yes. I was just curious how you met and what that's all about.
Well, I've worked with people in that kind of position all my life. I mean, I've worked with the Carters, and I knew Mrs. Roosevelt when I was very, very young. I was student president of my high school, which was just five blocks away from where Mrs. Roosevelt lived. And she had retired from the UN, and she was gathering young people around, young leaders, to get us interested in the United Nations. I remember one day she said to me, "My dear, if you're going to be in professional life making a difference as a woman, you can expect to get trashed. But remember, a woman is like a tea bag. You put her in hot water, and she just gets stronger." Anyway, Mrs. Clinton, who I met and was actually shared time with both the president and Mrs. Clinton, and stayed with them for 3 days at, Camp David. They liked me, and so they kept asking me to come back. And so I was there a whole lot, helping to do a lot of things, but among them helped Mrs. Clinton to write a book. It was I and a number of other people called It Takes a Village. I helped prepare her for India and other things, and I would have deep talks with the president as well on international affairs. He was especially interested in my ancestry because Sam Houston was my great-great-great-grandfather, and Robert E. Lee was also a senator.
Good. Well, if you have been an advisor there, then should she decide to run for president, I would look very seriously.
Yeah, but I did not download Mrs. Roosevelt in the cosmos. There was no spiritualism. I just asked her once, what would she have done to have tried to make a better world for, what does she think Mrs. Roosevelt would have done to make a better world for children? That's all there was to it. But, you know, the press does what it does, and it took off and made up a story. But that's what you run into. But I found her to be just the opposite of her public perception that's been there on the media. She was very wise and very deep, extremely generous, very kindly woman, of very great depth, huge, huge, almost Elizabethan sense of humor. And then so when I see this portrait of her by the media, it's not anybody that I know.
I know them.
I think she does have a chance at the presidency. I mean, so much can happen between now and 2008. It's silly to even speculate at this point.
Sure. Well, hopefully we're going in a softer direction.
But the really, truly great people are the Carters, quite frankly. I was taken down to be with them in their home in Plains, Georgia, and I found them to be just luminous, deeply spiritual, and extraordinarily brilliant, compassionate people.
Yeah, he was almost too nice a guy for the nation at the time.
Well, he could be, but I think he'll be remembered and honored in very positive ways.
I would agree as time goes on here. I know that you have studied myth, and
yes,
you wrote
quite extensively.
Wrote a book about Isis and Osiris.
And the Odyssey and Rumi and many, many. I've written about lots of myths. I actually have 204 unpublished 400-page manuscripts here. Of mine. I had to write a small book every month, and actually still do a lot of that. By the time it's delivered in the seminar, it's 400 pages. But I've probably written on almost all the major myths of the world.
Well, we'll be reading your work then long after you've gone. But I was curious, in Giorgio de Santayana's work, the former professor of the history of science at MIT,
yes.
He and Hertha wrote Hamlet's Mill. And
yes, a brilliant, brilliant book.
Yeah, loved
unique.
It.
For its time and for our time, too.
Very much so. And yet they sort of took the idea that myth is more of a scientific language. And then I suppose there's another school, the Joseph Campbell or Carl Jung school,
yeah.
That it's a little more of a collective articulation of human archetypes.
Yes.
And where would you fall sort of between?
Well, I think what you've just said is all true. It's both and plus much, much more. Myth is like a beautiful country that is always receding. The closer you get to it, the more it recedes. I think in part myth is the DNA of the human psyche. It gives us the story of who we are, where we are, where we're going, and it unfolds differently for one era and for another. Archetypes, which are, of course, great patterns that resound through myth, are also always in a changing pattern. I mean, the goddess Athena, for example, who is something of a warrior goddess in the Iliad, she has already changed in the Odyssey, written perhaps 20 or 30 years later, where she becomes the great evocateur of the hero's destiny in helping people to become all that they can be. So that you really have, we are always growing archetypes. Myth is always in a pattern of unfolding. I remember in India some years ago watching the Ramayana, the great story of Rama and Sita, and how Sita is abducted and Rama has to save her with an army of monkeys, among other things. And the old lady, the old Brahmin lady sitting next to me watching this said, "Oh, I don't like Princess Sita. She is much too passive. We have to change the story. Women are much stronger than that." I said, "But madam, the story is at least 3,000 years old." She said, "All the more reason why we have to change it. It is a very bad example for people in India. My name is Sita. My husband's name is Rama. Very common in India. He is a lazy bum. Anything happened, I would have to rescue him. We have to change the story." So you're actually seeing the growth and the changing of these great mythic powers within ourselves. And what we're looking for now is we are between stories, we in the West. We are at the end of one story. We are not at the beginning of the new one, and we are the people who are feeling the engendering of a new story within us, which certainly has to do not with the lonely hero, but with men and women together and people of different ages and ethnicities working together to co-create a new world. That's the new emerging mythos.
And I agree. You know, it's not so much that we're in between. It's just that we're hardly recognizing the new story that is beginning.
Yes. And that's why people like yourself and myself are trying to tell or evokes the news story in people as we meet them.
Well, you're doing a beautiful job at it, and I could talk to you for days and days, but unfortunately our time has already come to an end here today. And so I want to thank you again, Gene, for being on the show, and once again remind our listeners that if you'd like more information on Gene Houston, any of her books or any of her wonderful seminars or programs, the Mystery School is just a famous work that she's undertaken, please go to genehouston.org, or you can call her telephone number anytime during business hours, West Coast business hours. That is 541-488-1200, 541-488-1200. Thank you again, Gene. I hope to talk to you again soon.
Indeed. Thank you so much, Walter.
Expanding your mind. HealthyLife.net.
Once again, this is Cosmic Influence. I'm Walter Cruttenden, and we've just concluded our show with Gene Houston, the author of Jump Time and about 24 other books. She's really an amazing person and really one who is articulating what is happening here in this awakening age, perhaps more than any other. Again, for those that would like more information on the cosmic influence and this whole idea of cycles and the awakening that we see occurring right now, I would encourage you to go to our website, which is binaryresearchinstitute.org. Or for more information on my book, Lost Star of Myth and Time, simply go to loststarbook.com. Also, we're putting together our conference on Procession and Ancient Knowledge again for next year. It'll probably be held at UCI again, and we'd like to invite any of you that have ideas for speakers to drop us an email, and you can just write to me at walter@thegreatyear.com. So this has been Cosmic Influence. I'm Walter Cruttenden, and we will see you next time. In the meantime, bring on the higher ages.